Thank you, Marissa. Bucky's Auto Service Centers. Trust the guys and gals there. My goodness gracious, nothing worse than having your car break down or something be wrong with your car. You walk in, you say to the mechanic, you think you can fix it? Oh, yeah, let me take a look at that for you. They don't do any work. Then Jesse shows up from Cairo. You'll never see Jesse Jones over there at Bucky's Auto Service Center. Down there! I know I've been taken advantage of by auto mechanics, Ursula.
How do you know that? Why? Why are you being taken advantage?
Well, it's late at night. I've had a couple drinks. I'm in a bar, and then you mean with the auto mechanic?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know.
Because you don't know much about
I don't know about cars. And you bring it in. Yeah. Not locally, here, but other place. You drive in there, and then like yeah. Mm-hmm. And they don't do
everything's
anything.
At least $1,000.
And all they do is like recorrect, connect a wire or something like that. All right, here we go. Hannah Scott is joining. Boy, everybody's on the phone. Nobody wants to come in here anymore. Hannah Scott is talking about the fact that, do we even have to have her music even though she's not really technically here?
I think it's still nice.
All right, Hannah Scott normally comes in here with her boots on. Super duper outfits. Hannah, so yesterday we had the Jay Inslee, who wants to be president of the United States, had a big press conference talking all about how even though we had rejected soundly the carbon tax, he says, listen, we're going to be able in the new sort of makeup of an Olympia, we're going to be able to push through and we're going to lead the world. Washington will lead the world when it comes to climate change legislation.
Yep, that's the goal. So he rolled out this very ambitious plan, as he called it yesterday. What it does, would eliminate fossil fuels like natural gas and coal by 2045, requiring all utilities in the state to provide carbon-free electricity by then. Again, 2045. Mm-hmm. There are incentives to boost the use of electric vehicles, phasing out of what he called a super pollutant. It's hydrofluorocarbon, that's the kind of stuff they use in air conditioning and refrigerators. Mm-hmm. Turning our ferries, our transportation system, electric. So the Wenatchee and the Puyallup are what we have that are jumbo ferries. They have four diesel engines. This would make them hybrids. So two of those engines would be switched to batteries. And then he would also have money, I think it's $64 million for two new all-electric ferries. And then there's a new clean fuel standard targeting low emissions for your cars. It's similar to what they have in Hawaii and California. What is not in here is a carbon tax, like the one that just failed at the ballot.
Mm-hmm. When you propose a package, it doesn't presuppose not doing some other package. This is the package we believe that fits our ability to pass legislation this year. I'm not ruling out anything else in the next decade or so. This is what we're doing today.
So that is not being ruled out at the moment. Now, Republicans, you talked about at the beginning that the Democrats had some big gains in the legislature this last election. So that's certainly going to help. And especially a lot of the new candidates that won election this time around are very big supporters of clean energy and the carbon tax and various things like that. So he will have a lot of support, but there's going to be a lot of backlash and a lot of fight coming from Republicans. I expect that to be led by Republican Senator Doug Erickson, who says this is just a tax in disguise.
He's sending every indication that he's going to use this new energy tax proposal as some type of his potential springboard to national prominence and his run for the presidency.
So the governor was asked, what is this going to cost, right? We're talking about changes to your utilities, things like that. What is going to be the ultimate cost for the taxpayer?
I think that it will avoid enormous costs that a path of inaction would take. We got to understand our choice in Washington State. The choice is between inaction and action. The costs of inaction are enormous.
And here's what he has to say about that question about whether this is all about his possible run for the White House in 2020.
I don't think anybody who cares about their children cares about anybody's electoral prospects.
Right.
I think they care about a state where you don't wake up in the morning and there's ash on the hood of your car because the forests are all burning down.
Right.
So that's referencing the new federal study that came out. He also referenced a recent study that I think UW had something to do with that said we're basically on the path, same path that we were 252 million years ago when the Great Dying happened, I believe is what it was called, big extinction event.
Right.
A couple of interesting things here. The coal, it calls for the elimination of the use of coal for utilities by 2025, I believe. And there's a what's called a poison pill, right? In the big transportation package that passed back in 2015, there was like this bomb in there that said if they did anything like this on the, I'm sorry, on the clean fuel standard by in that package, then it would trigger cuts in transportation to things like transit and bike paths. So when the clean fuel standard he's included here, he gets around that by kind of just phasing it in a little bit later.
I see. Does he start, didn't he start the press conference by talking about children?
He did. This was, he was very passionate, and this is about love is what he said. So this was, it was all about love. It was all about the children and for the children's future and the state's future and thing like that. It was a pretty emotional start to the speech.
Yes. And by the way, just to let everybody know, if any politician starts out with children, it's a politically bankrupt argument. So whenever you start with, this is for the kids, we're doing it for the kids, it's all about your kids, nonsense. And he goes on to talk about what honor and duty or something like that. And we have to do this for love, for love, for love. Yeah, this is Jay Inslee would like to be president. And this is a very interesting position path to get to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, which is I have a state that has now we are fully implementing everything that the Paris Peace Accord set up, plus even more so. We're going to even be more draconian than what they're doing in California. We are going to lead the way. This is his bully pulpit that allows him to get national attention. You wait and see. He does a press conference, and some it'll pick up on the fact that, hey, look at all these interesting things. And once it gets into the battle into Olympia, it allows him to stand on top of this thing and be able to cry, this is for the kids. I'm doing it for the kids.
Now, listen, you know, he already got massive national attention because of his strong support for 1631, which just failed, right, at the ballot. All the whole country was watching that because states wanted to see if they could follow suit. And he had a lot of support for that. He spoke about it a lot on national network television. This, if he can pull this off, he will definitely get some big wins there. And he has said before, he expects the 2020 election, the presidential election, for climate change and changes for global warming and to avoid all of that would be a central part of the 2020 presidential election. Mm-hmm. We'll see if that's true.
Tom?
Well, first off, I think appealing to the children makes a lot of sense if you're trying to get legislation passed that's not going to really have any effect until 2045 and 2050. One of the problems about our politics is we are short-term, just like we're short-term in just about anything we do because we're humans. It's a lot easier to look at something, you know, 5 years down the road or a year down the road and say, okay, yeah, I'll pay for that, rather than 40 or 50 years down the road. And that's why you have to make the appeal to children. It's not a bankrupt idea. It's that's the pitch to get us to give up our hard-earned dollars today to save money down the line, and that's hard to come off. So anyway, that's my retort to that. I also am not sure, first off, if this is, because I don't think Jay Inslee is going to run, and even if he does, I don't think he has a chance of actually winning. But if his effort at trying to win the presidency or the Democratic nomination means that we get all this stuff passed, I'm all for it. I mean, I don't have a problem with any of this. What this seems to be a relatively modest effort at, you know, moving toward more toward clean energy, because he's not going for the carbon tax. He's not going to say, I'm going to cram this through now that we have more Democrats. He's going to say, this is something I think we can, you know, get through the legislature, and it'll be, it may be a first step, but it's a first step. And he's not leading the way, John. In fact, the Seattle Times article even indicates he is just following California's lead. So it's not that he's the standard bearer at this point. He's just trying to get on board something that he thinks is a good idea.
Right. Well, Tom, so let's say it's not a tax necessarily, so they're not going to tax it on top. But if you increase the cost of energy, if you were paying X for a certain amount of kilowatt hours, and now you're paying X plus because it costs more in order to produce that, because they're adding to the additional cost because you have to supplement the green energy. So it's not a tax, but it doesn't matter. You don't have to call it a tax. It's an increased price for what you were paying for before. So he doesn't call it a tax. It's a sneaky way to increase the cost of something and not calling it tax, if you will.
Well, and it's not a fee or a tax like it would be on producers. Like the thing that just went to the ballot. But there are various things in here, like you could, you know, your utilities, your heating and things like that. There could be some costs down the line because of these changes. Also, the clean fuel standard that's based off of what they have in California and Hawaii. In California, that's led to, I think it's a 3 to 6 cents jump in your gas, in your fuel.
No more ash on the hood of your car, kids. Yeah! All right. There we go.
Electric fairies, kids. Hey, where do the kids go?
Try something else.
Try something else, Tom. For the kids. What else you got? What
electric
you got?
Fairies.
Nope.
Incentives. Is there a delay or something? For electric cars.
Incentives for electric cars. Kids, incentives for electric cars. Yeah, we like that because rich people take advantage of incentives for electric cars while poor people pay for it. All right, thank you, Hannah Scott. Appreciate it.
You bet.
All right, there goes Hannah out the door. Let me hold on, Hannah. Gee whiz. So many buttons to push. My life is so complicated. Tom. Yeah. Gotta get in here on Friday. People pay $15,000 to watch the show. They don't want to see me pushing buttons. They want to see you. And especially
no,
see
they
but
want
no, to... here's the beauty of it. You come in, you're all messed up, your leg's up on a chair, we got to put a pillow underneath it, people are constantly coming in and giving you aspirin. They're really going to feel like they're seeing a show, and it's going to look like you came back just for them.
For them.
Just
that's
for
true.
Them.
I like it.
Yeah, kids are excited to know you're coming back, Tom. All right, here we go. I'm going to run that into the ground.
I'll do it for the kids.
Okay, good. Let's see. Do you care about Time Magazine and what they're doing, the Guardians of the Truth? Yes or no?
Well, yeah, I think it's an interesting discussion. The Time Person of the Year is, you know, it's sort of lived past its due date. However, I do think it's a valuable, time to discuss what is of most significance in our world right now. And the idea that the Guardians and the War on Truth, it is true that there are journalists around the world are under extreme attack, mm-hmm. and they highlight four individuals. Khashoggi is the most the most prominent yeah. of them, and it's the first time they've ever nominated or announced someone who is deceased, mm-hmm. as they say. The only hesitation I have on this, because I think they make a compelling argument, my only hesitation on this is that it feels a little self-serving that a journalistic endeavor announces that journalists are the most important people of the year.
Right.
So it's only that aspect of it that gives me some pause. And my understanding is individual number one was the runner-up, President Trump, and then Robert Mueller was person three. So of those three, I think that, I'm okay with that. How do you feel?
You're right. It is self-serving, but here is the editor talking about it briefly.
As we looked at the choices, it became clear that the manipulation and abuse of truth is really the common thread in so many of this year's major stories, from Russia to Riyadh to Silicon Valley. And so we chose to highlight four individuals and one group who have taken great risks in pursuit of greater truth, starting with Jamal Khashoggi.
Jamal Khashoggi, yeah. Why did you select him?
Well, it's interesting. This is the first time we've ever chosen someone no longer alive mm-hmm. as Person of the Year, but it's also very rare that a person's influence grows so immensely in death. And his murder has prompted a global reassessment of the Saudi crown prince and a really long overdue look at the devastating war in Yemen.
Okay. So, by the way, Trump won in 2016 because they say Trump, Time Magazine says it's for better or for worse. It's a person who's most influenced the news.
Oh, yeah. Right. No. No, I get that. So Silicon Valley, that was a nice dig at Silicon Valley, too, in terms of this war on truth that people are dissembling wherever we look. And I also wondered, John, if this isn't kind of a veiled crack at the president, even though
absolutely.
They don't mention him.
Yeah, you put those guys on the cover, but you keep to, because who else is everybody thinking about? They thinking about the journalists from Saudi Arabia? No. They thinking about the other people? No. That it's an attack on the truth and we need to defend the truth and democracy dies in the darkness. That's mm-hmm. that's the banner now mm-hmm. at the New York Times, and it's all about, oh, Trump's nothing but a liar, so therefore, yeah, it's a shot at Trump. Good job, Time Magazine. Let's see. We don't have time for the neo-Nazi thing. We'll have to move that forward. Just real quick, talk about the fact that, three, four big, heavy topics, Tom. We can't take care of those in the last 2 minutes. Here we go. Just this one real
fast. How about
the
South Korean business?
Do you want to do that one or you do masculine faces?
Okay. They're both light.
Recent study confirms what people have described for a long time. They got about 250 different subjects. They had them clearly identify, is this person male or female? And once they said, are they male or female, which of these two faces or all these faces that we're showing you does the person seem to be more competent? And mm-hmm. it's overwhelmingly people, both male and female, describe the male face as more competent than the female face.
That's right. And this is of concern to people because they say we have these biases. In other words, just because you look competent doesn't mean you are competent. Mm-hmm. And they say they're quick to point that out. And they say, however, if we have this kind of, and they don't indicate what kind of bias. Is it a cultural bias? Is it some kind of genetic bias? Is it a, however the bias is that if we have a bias toward that, then will that, you know, trip us up in effect? And right now it seems that, we naturally gravitate to a more patriarchal, image of authority and, power than a matriarchal. And because of that, women might be getting the short end of the stick. Not that that's any surprise, but they say that's indicative. And they can actually manipulate women's faces to look more masculine. As they look more masculine, they get more positive feedback in terms of their authority. But
well, what you're supposed to do to determine whether or not the person is an alpha male or a person that deserves to have the idea that they're competent is you should measure the face, and they look at men's faces, and they determine on another study, this is the sign of an alpha male is the perfect facial width and height ratio. So men with shorter, wider faces are more likely to have a higher sex drive, cheat on their partners, and perhaps be even better leaders. So they have a stronger libido. So then they want you to take out a tape measure and measure your face to determine whether or not you have the proper dimensions to be able to say whether or not you are more likely to cheat or more likely be an alpha male.
So is that the same as the idea of beauty? Are there different beauty marks? They often say like the Roman sculpture, they have like the perfectly proportioned faces, and they're considered more handsome or more beautiful. And I wonder if the image is different for whatever these guys are. The shorter, shorter faces, you say?
Yeah, you're supposed to measure from the top of your forehead down to the tip of your nose, and then from the bottom of, or the top of your lip down to your chin, and then from cheekbone to cheekbone. And the measurement comes out, and if it fits within a certain range, that person is an alpha male, and they're also likely to be more dominant. They're likely to be less monogamous, just overall. But, yeah, I saw the science thing on the science of beauty where they took a mathematical equation of distance from eyes and then the distance, the length of the nose and all that other stuff, right?
And how important symmetry is.
Right.
And right, most of us are not symmetrical.
Tom, two of us with our long, narrow, wonderful faces. We'll be right back. Here we go. Online Training Academy text line 98973, 98973. Come on in. Everybody gets a chance to have the word on the show. Questions, comments, and concerns. Somebody gets a chance to be letter of the day. Certainly do appreciate it. By the way, just to bring you up to speed, Tom, during one of the commercial breaks, when I was half listening to all of the great sponsors selling products and services that you should rush out and buy right now, I went online, and what did I buy, Jacob?
An enema?
For my nose.
Right.
So on Friday,
deliverable by Friday.
Yes, I got the because I'm Amazon Prime, and for Friday, when you pay $15,000 to come in and watch the Tom and Curly show, it includes not only Tom in a leg brace, it includes me getting you to stick an enema in my nose and having it pour out the other side. That's all part of the show.
Is that otherwise known as a neti pot?
No. I went ahead because I said I don't want to do the neti pot. So I went on Amazon. What did I buy, Jacob?
It's one of those old-fashioned, like, hot water balloons.
Yeah, it's a big old, like, water bottle thing. But you put water in it, then you hold it up in the air, and then the tube comes down. The water goes in. It's supposed to go into your bottom. But instead, I'm going to have Tom stick it in my nose so it comes out the other side.
So did you promise this guest tricks? Or why? Why are you doing this?
Because radio is a visual medium. This is an audio medium, and you need to, during the commercial breaks, you got to do something to keep them entertained. Okay, Tom.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
That's right.
Andrew, you in on this?
No.
All right, fine. Here we go. Tom, you and I have had this discussion numerous times, and is reading better than listening. In 1977, they did a study with college students that listened to a short story that were available, and then they had them summarize. And what they found was when it came to the accuracy and the comprehension, those that listened was equal to those that read. So it's been kicked around for a long time. It seems to a lot of people that to listen to a book is a form of cheating, that you really need to read it. listening to it, it feels like, you know, the balding orphan or the stepchild, that it's not quite as good. You haven't really read the book until you've actually sat down and read it.
Yeah, and this article basically says, relax, that reading and listening are two different skills, and there are benefits from the two different skills, that one isn't necessarily better than the other, and since reading is sort of seen as the, you know, the superior child to listening, one kind of evolutionary component to this might set we readers back, us readers back, a step, because they point out writing is less than 6,000 years old, and that's not enough time for evolution to create specialized mental processes for reading, so we end up using the same mental mechanism that evolved to understand oral language for written language. So one could say that we are biologically or DNA created to listen rather than read, that reading might be at a higher level, but we're working with a body that operates better with listening. Another aspect when you're listening to a story that's better is in terms of intent. When you write something sarcastic and write something sincere, there's no necessary understanding when you're reading it. But when you listen to it, you can pick up things like tone of voice that clearly indicates what's important and what's not. Like, oh yeah, you look great, John. They could tell that is sarcastic, whereas if you just write it out, you look great, John, you might not read it that way. And they say things like, wherefore art thou, Romeo? When you're just reading it, you wouldn't realize that basically you're saying, why is your name Romeo? You would stress Romeo. When you hear it, the actor stressing Romeo, you understand it better than if you were just reading it. Those are the benefits. Then the benefits for reading make more sense. If you're just reading for pleasure, if you're just sort of soaking up an experience, that's fine. There's no difference between listening and reading. But if you're reading a difficult text, if you're trying to understand some kind of economic argument or a thesis or something, it's much better to read, because you can't pick up everything as you are. You know, if you're just listening to it, you need to take notes. You need to be able to go back and forth. So, I mean, it's basically kind of, you know, it's good and bad on either. That's why I always give you credit when you say, well, I don't know if I read a book, I listened to books. I think that's absolutely, that's, to me, that's as comparable as reading a book, because a lot of us don't read books to take notes. We read books to get the general gist.
Well, I listen to the books on tape from Audible, right? And so here's the speed.
Capital gains. They have few capital losses. More than from a stratified system governed by educational and other credentials that the rich can buy.
So what I try to jack up the speed, because I want to be able to listen to it and get through it faster.
The only dependable route from poverty is always work, family, and faith. The first principle is that in order to move up, the poor must not only work, they must work harder than the classes above them. Every previous generation of the lower class has made such efforts.
So I'm trying to train my brain to be able to listen to it at a 2x speed.
Well, I was going to say, even that, I would need to read whatever. I mean, that's, there you're talking about economics and that kind of stuff. That, I think, is difficult. By the way, one other benefit from listening is that they say people tend to multitask. So people are, you know, like doing the laundry or washing the dishes as they're listening. And so you can kill two birds with one stone. However, they say lots of studies have proven that you don't pick up nearly as much if you're reading something as opposed to listening to something while you're doing the dishes. You get much more out of the actual reading. The counter argument is, but listen, if I was just normally doing the dishes, at least I am getting, you know, more info than not if I, you know, multitask. So
do you miss, do you do both, you read and then listen to books on tape, would you rather hear the author in your voice or in their voice?
Now, what do you mean by in my voice?
So when you read, don't you hear, aren't you hearing the words in your head?
Oh, I see. Yes. Oh, no. I would much rather listen to. Yeah, that's a great question, John. I would much rather listen to how the author presents it, just because I'm curious about the words that come out of the author's, brain. Yeah. However, I do notice that I'm also more critical. Like, you know, I'm a big fan of Hillary Clinton, but I think Hillary Clinton reading her own book, What Happened, it sounds terrible. Uh-huh. It's not. I'd rather she'd have done a better job if she'd hired me to read her book.
if she had asked you to read it,
right? Or you, John? Somebody else? Yeah. So I do understand why authors don't often read their books, because they're not as mellifluous in their delivery as they maybe should. But I love to hear the writer.
I listened to a book about Alone Together, a guy that sailed from California to Hawaii by himself, single-handing a boat, a 38-foot sailboat.
More needs to be done. We are Newton's billiard ball in motion until some other force.
And what I love about it is the fact that it's his own voice, it's his own story, and while he's reading it, you can hear the frustration in his voice. You hear, and because he's aware of the problems. I don't know enough about sailing to understand why that's a problem, but yeah, he is telling me, without using the words, but just the sound of his voice tells me that later on will be a problem that he's going to have to deal with, you know, I don't know, 15 or 20 minutes from now. So, all right, good. I don't feel like I'm cheating then when it comes to listening to books on tape. Good. All right.
You're well read, John.
Thank you, Tom. Well listened to. We'll come back. We'll talk about the fact that when they wanted to find the Titanic, the U.S. Navy said, yes, we will help you find the Titanic, but we'd like you to do something kind of secretive on the side so that the Russians don't get wind of it. We'll be right back. Too bad Dan Restione doesn't still work at Cairo, because, man, he loves the Titanic, right, and anything having to do with the Titanic, he would be all over it. Really great story. The guy that had invented this submarine that was able to go to great depths and to be able to search for different things, he decided he wanted to go try to find the Titanic. And he went to the Navy, said, can you help me fund this as I go to find the Titanic? And the Navy said, yeah, I'll tell you what, why don't you do this? You do us a favor first, and then we'll help you go out and try to find the Titanic with this new exploration sub that you've built. What did the Navy want him to do, Tom?
Find two missing nuclear subs that sunk in the Atlantic in the 1960s.
Right.
So this was in 19, we're in the 80s when we're talking about this, though. And they said, okay, we will help finance, because you couldn't get any science foundations to support this. It wasn't seen as scientific enough to find the Titanic. And so he made this arrangement, with the U.S. government that they will fund his effort at looking at the Titanic, but they had an X amount, they had a certain, window of time, and he was charged with finding the subs before he found Titanic. And so it took much longer to find the particular Scorpion sub that they were looking for, that he only had like 13 days or something to find the Titanic. And son of a gun, if he didn't find it in 8 days, and the rest is a history. And the great thing about this is it was all a secret mission. He was publicly announcing to the world, I'm looking for the Titanic.
Right.
And that tricked the Russians. I mean, they were afraid that the Russians would get suspicious if we started looking for a sub. And so under the guise of looking for the Titanic, he was really looking for the, doing the U.S. military's bidding. And then, luckily, at the last second, he found the Titanic as well. The Russians were never caught wise, and we got our sub back.
Right. So he told the world, I'm going under and I'm looking for the Titanic. And then he went over to the Azores. I think that's where they ended up finding the sub. It was about 3,000 meters of water, and the site is reported to be 400 meters southwest of the Azores. So they went down there and found, and they were afraid that they don't want the Russians to find the sub, because this was the sub that was used to spy on the Russians, and it had all sorts of nuclear things in it. And they thought, if the Russians find it, they'll pull the thing up and they'll be able to sort of figure out what we're doing or what we're looking for, or how we're able to sort of get around some of their radar or sonar. So kind of cool story that comes out now. I don't know why it finally broke, or if somebody found about it. Has the guy written a story or a book or something? Or
He's talking to CBS, actually, yeah.
Okay, got it. Good. There you go. A little bit of history for you. Come right back. Yeah, Tom, a bunch of good stories to get to. We'll talk about the Seahawks.
Seahawks.
But what happened to Russell Wilson yesterday?
Oh, my God.
Somebody hit him in the head with a frying pan. We'll be right back.
Yeah.